Major Henry Hall was one of the first people in Britain to be trained in the procedures, techniques, I suppose philosophy of guerrilla warfare in Britain. Now, at the age of 22, you went off to Inverellert House. Why? I mean, let's begin at the beginning. The first question, why was there a need in 1940 for guerrilla warfare?
After the Norwegian campaign, it was blatantly obvious that amongst many other deficiencies of the British Army, nobody was trained in guerrilla warfare. The Germans were excellent at ambushing people in Norway, and we just didn't have the skill. And so Bill Sterling, after having taken part in that campaign, got permission from Colin Gubbins, who started off everything, SOE, commandos, you name it, to start up a school to teach guerrilla warfare at Inverellert in Scotland.
Did you have to volunteer for this, or were you volunteered?
We were volunteered. I was stationed at Canterbury at the time with my battalion, 4 Dorset, and called into the CO's office one day. There was a sergeant there as well. We were told we were going on an advanced assault course at Inverellert. And that was that. No idea what it was all about.
What was your first reaction to the place when you turned up? I mean, what were you met by?
We went up from Canterbury by train and eventually arrived at Fort William. And then we were put on the puffer train, the old fish train, which went from Fort William to Mallaig. And when we got just short of Lough Islet Station, railway station, the train came under fire. Machine guns, mortars and so on. The driver obviously was in the picture and slammed on everything he got. And of course we were all tossed into the onto the floor, and kit bags off the luggage racks and so on. And we wondered what the hell was going on. And lots of chaps, instructors, leapt out of holes in the ground and said, "Get out of the train, get out of the train, grab all your kit and follow us." And they were shooting at us from then, that moment on. We had to grab our kit and run about a mile and a half from the railway line down to the big house at Inverellert. And there on the lawn was a couple of distant huts. We were told that's where we were going to live. Go in there, take your kit and find yourself a bed. And that was our first introduction. All the way there we were being shot at. The ablutions were outside on the lawn, cold water, and whenever we did sleep in the huts, we had to get ourselves washed and clean with cold water, whether it was raining or not. And of course, in the west of Scotland, it's nearly always raining and cold. But we did feed in the... Where we did feed, we fed in the big house.
One of the areas you were taught in was close quarter fighting, and then basically silent killing. That you had two instructors there. Tell me about your introduction to them.
The first morning after we arrived there, we were taken into the big house, and in the big house there is a large stairway, I should think probably about 40 feet high and about 6 foot wide, with a couple of bends in it. And we were assembled at the foot of the stairs, and two dear old gentlemen who we afterward discovered, one was 56, the other was 58, they both wore glasses, and they were dressed in battle dress, and a belt, webbing belt. They walked along the landing, went tumbly-tumbly, falling down the stairs, and ended up at the bottom in a battle crouch position with a Fairburn Sykes fighting knife in one hand and a handgun in the other. And we discovered afterwards that they carried the fighting knife and the handgun in their trouser pockets. Your trouser pocket, normally you have to raise your hand a little bit to put your hand in the pocket. Well, the pockets were slipped down so that your hand went straight into the pocket, and the knife or the gun holster was sewn inside the pocket.
Where had they learnt this stuff? I mean, these two kindly faced, fairly lethal gentlemen.
I beg pardon?
Where had they learnt these skills?
Now, Fairburn and Sykes were both... they'd both served in the Shanghai police for very many years. Dan Fairburn was the first European to be awarded a black belt. Sykes had been... he'd worked for Remington before he joined us, the Shanghai police, and was a hunt, wild game hunter as well. And they'd learnt their skills on the waterfront in Shanghai with amongst all the gangs, drug traffickers, and you know, on the international area of Shanghai. And they'd honed their skills by sheer experience on the ground.
What type of things did they teach you?
Basically dirty tricks. Close quarter combat. The use of the knife. Fairburn and Sykes went into Wilkins's in Pall Mall one day and described to the owners what kind of fighting knife they wanted. And it was a double-edged 7-inch blade, the whole knife being made of metal. And the idea was that you could use it for cutting or stabbing, but the reason why it was 7.5 inches long was the because on the battlefield or anywhere else, if you stick a knife into somebody, you get covered in blood 9 times out of 10. And but they had a particular place that they'd learnt with in Shanghai, which the gangs and things use sometimes, called the subclavian thrust, which is putting the knife into the shoulder blade and pressing it down, which cuts the subclavian artery. And as the blade is 7.5 inches long, it also pierces the top of the lung. And so the blood from the artery goes into the lung, and the fellow is drowned in his own blood. The book says 5 seconds the fellow would be... 3 seconds, rather, the book says. But it's difficult to tell when you do it yourself. But I reckon he's dead in about 5 seconds. Mm-hmm. But the point being that you don't get covered in blood.
What other skills were you taught on this course?
Handgun work. Fairburn and Sykes had developed a special technique with a handgun. Firing not with your arm out or using the sights, something like that. Simply...
Sorry, can I ask you that again? No, just... It's a nice clock, but it's going to get right through the middle of that. It's going to make it hell to edit. I'll ask it again in a moment.
Sounds like it's winding up.
There you go. What are the... Sorry, I'll ask you that question again so we can edit it. What other techniques did you learn in training?
After the knife was the handgun. Now, Fairbairn and Sykes had discovered in Shanghai that the most effective way of using a handgun was to not point the gun or use the sights or anything of that sort, but to draw the gun, put it at your navel, and point towards your target. And as most handguns are anything up to 9mm, and they favour the 9mm Browning, two shots, because one shot won't stop the chap. So it was called the Fairbairn Sykes double tap. And Fairbairn himself could draw and fire two shots in a third of a second. We had to do that, not in a third of a second, but again, if we missed our target, we were out.
That's something I wanted to ask you about, because you're taught to live off the land, you're taught sabotage, you're taught the use of explosives, you're taught the use of, you know, close-quarter fighting. How much was there a toleration of failure?
No toleration whatsoever. If, say, you had to get from A to B across the mountains, or now and again they used to give you a job where you had to cross a loch as well as a mountain. If you failed to arrive on time, you were sent back to your unit straight away. If you didn't master any of the techniques that were taught, again you were sent back. If you moaned or groaned or said, oh, I can't do this, I can't do that, in other words, if you didn't show a fighting spirit, again you were sent back.
How inured did you become to physical discomfort? Because you talk about crossing lochs and things.
Well, we just had to put up with it. The way to Scotland is wet and cold most of the time. And we had two one-day exercises, we had assault landings, we had night exercises, lots and lots of night exercises. We were taken off, taken across by landing craft, did an assault landing on Skye, and attacked also Portree, Broadford, and one or two other places on Skye, and eventually taken off by destroyer. And so basically all the time we were tired, hungry, wet, and generally exhausted. And if you didn't come up to scratch and that sort of thing, again you were sent back.
The purpose of this training in 1940 was to prepare for a possible German invasion, so that you and people like you could go to ground and harry an invasion force. That wasn't required. Did you get the chance to use what you'd been taught?
Yes, I was very lucky, because having come back from Inverarlet, we went back to our battalions and we formed a unit called a battle patrol, which had exactly the same role as the British resistance movement. In other words, as soon as the Germans had landed, to lie low and then come up and kill, sabotage, disrupt communications, blow up dumps, and generally make a nuisance of ourselves. The British resistance movement, because the Germans didn't land, they never had to put that out into actual practice. Whereas we were fortunate enough to go to whatever theatre of war we were sent with our battalions, and we went, our battle patrols went as an ordinary infantry battalion and fought as an ordinary infantry battalion, but we selected our targets during the day, exactly the same as the resistance movement would have done, and then attacked them at night. And also, of course, we had we were taught to attack tanks and destroy tanks. And we did quite a lot of that during the day, sniping them. And on one occasion on July the 10th, 44, my battalion, we did an attack at 20 past 6 in the morning. and captured a little village on Hill 112 in Normandy. And then we did another one at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, which was a mad jack attack, really, because there was swarm. The village we were attacking was swarming with Tiger tanks. And we hung on there until about 8 o'clock. And because these Tiger tanks were up there, we had lovely chance. We got rid of about three or four of them because we knew how, whereas the other chaps didn't.
Can I ask you, I know you won the Military Cross. What was it for?
The citations are always wrong. My citation says that I won it for helping to get my battalion across the river, across the Rhine at Arnhem. Four Dorset were sent across on the night after the Poles were sent across to draw the Germans away from the airborne in order to the airborne could be withdrawn. And they said I got it for helping on that. But in actual fact, I got it for killing more Germans than most other people. after the airborne had withdrawn, I went across the river for three or four nights running. It was rather interesting because the first night I went across, I popped in and saw Sosabowski, the Polish general. And I said, do you want me to bring any of your Poles back? He said, no. And he said, oh, no. He said, you kill the Germans. He said, my Poles, he said, they will stay there and fight until they are dead.
I admit, I it's not often I hesitate asking a question, but this seems almost ludicrously personal. How many men do you think you've killed?
I have no idea. I did a program about the British resistance movement a few months ago, which is that we're being shown on the BBC History Programme, and I was asked exactly the same question. And I made exactly the same answer. And the chap said, the interviewer said, well, was it 20? And I said, oh, no, much more than 20. He said, was it 40? I said, well, maybe, but I really didn't keep a count. I kept a count of how many Tiger tanks I destroyed.
How many
That was 17. But I never kept an account of how many men I destroyed.
Was that deliberate? Because I can't imagine killing over 20, 30 men and not remembering them. I mean, why can't you remember them?
Well, I never kept a score.
But it's not a score. I mean, you know, you're talking about taking a human life. Surely it must stick in your memory sufficiently that you could say that happened there and that happened there and that happened there.
Well, not really. I mean, it was just part of the job. I mean, if you're an ordinary infantry platoon, and when we were fighting as an ordinary infantry platoon, we killed the enemy, but we didn't count how many we killed. Mm-hmm. We just killed the enemy who were in the position that we were supposed to occupy.
I suppose this question is particularly appropriate given what's happening in the Middle East at the moment, because it seems to me that we are constantly trying to take the moral high ground and saying we're playing by the rules and the other chap isn't.
Yeah.
The entire purpose of your training was not to play by the rules.
No, it wasn't. No, the whole purpose of our training really was to not exactly disregard the rules, but to bend the rules. Fairburn's motto was that if you think our methods of close quarter combat are not cricket, remember that Hitler doesn't play this game.
Mm. Have you ever looked back at that period and regretted it? Have you ever thought, you know, has there ever been a question mark in your mind about it?
No, because I mean, the thing is about warfare is that if you take it seriously, I mean, you have to take it seriously to learn the techniques and the methods of attacking or crossing rivers or house clearing or something of that sort. You have to learn that. If you take things too seriously, you just go bomb happy. You've got to brighten the battlefield up. It's rather like the cavalry, you know.
Brighten a battlefield up? That's an extraordinary statement.
They introduced the cavalry into warfare so that it wouldn't become a mere vulgar rout.
So how did you do that in World War II? How did you become the 20th century cavalry?
Well, I mean, for instance, we had my battle patrol had a totem pole. It was a 6-foot holly stick with a brass jug on the top. We all scratched our name on that, on the jug. And then we had a cow's skull on the top. We carried that into battle with us and planted that on our objective. We also had a war cry. On one occasion, I acted as an umpire for a Maori battalion and learnt the Maori haka, which is rather complicated. We modified it into a Maori Dorset haka.
How did it go? Can you remember it?
It was always our haka went, Tina ta tonga ta kora kora comedy comedy ya. Now, we use that. You can use it at the beginning of an attack or during an attack, or you can use it. One of the things to do with the enemy is to wear the buggers down, and you could use it as a mock war cry. You can send chaps out in the night. One or two, or two or three in groups, to give the old war cry. And if they happen to be asleep, it wakes them up. They wonder what's going to happen. And it's also very useful to, when they hear this extraordinary noise, they pop their heads up and give their positions away so you can shoot them.
Again, I apologise for coming back to this. Never having been in this position myself, and probably never will be, was there ever a stage where you came across an enemy sentry or an enemy soldier and thought, no, that's somebody's son, that's somebody's husband, father, whatever. You know, how do you kill someone without seeing them as a human being?
Well, you see, we were taught at Violet to shoot the chap and then ask his name, rank, and number afterwards. And that was the attitude.
Can I ask, I mean, nowadays much is made of, you know, battlefield stress and post-traumatic stress disorder and goodness knows what else. Was there ever any mention in your training of psychology or psychiatry or anything of the kind? Was that even taken into consideration?
The training at Inverarlet, there was absolutely no emphasis or mention of your psychological attitude. Because of the example of all the instructors, the Lovett Scouts too were there acting, giving demonstrations and generally helping. All the instructors there had devil may care and yet expertise attitude. Mike Calver, for example, he knew everything there was to know about explosives, and he would demonstrate that a pound slab of gun cotton wouldn't explode with the impact of a bullet by holding a slab of gun cotton in his hand and letting a Lovett Scout shoot at it. And we could see, it was obvious, they were all super, super confident and super efficient in their own jobs, in their own techniques, especially Fairburn and Sykes, we came away knowing that we were far, far better than anybody else. at killing somebody or blowing up a tank or blowing down a tree or cratering a road or whatever the particular job was.
How did you, I mean, did you have any difficulty at all when the war was over readjusting to being a civilian?
Well, it didn't really apply to me because I was a regular soldier and I didn't come out until 1956. And so I sort of wound down in the general postings, overseas postings and so on, after the war. But I think everybody must have some sort of reaction. And I mean, you cannot go through a period of a number of years killing people, destroying things, blowing things up, and generally living in a with your boots on for 3 or 4 weeks and filthy, dirty and smelly and everything else, tired and hungry, without it affecting you mentally in some way. And of course it comes out, I mean, the First World War it was called shell shock. In my world, it's called bomb happy. But I think everybody does suffer in a certain way.
How did you suffer?
Well, I used to wander off on my own and sort of think about things. And, but then that's about all, I think.
Have you ever felt set apart? I mean, thinking about it subjectively. So I'll ask that again. Have you ever felt set apart? Because the taking of human life is one of society's great taboos.
Quite, yes.
First commandment, thou shalt not kill.
Yeah.
Here you are, living in a community in Deeside, having killed 30 or 40 other human beings. And that's an experience that I can more or less guarantee no one else in this village will share.
I'm quite sure, yes.
Yeah, so do you feel different? Do other people see you as being different?
No, I don't think they do at all. I don't think they do at all. I mean, I've done one or two different programmes on television and for MIR and so on about all these techniques and what I did during the war, Daddy. a lot of people know about these programmes and so on, but... Nobody sort of sets me apart.
I notice, I mean, just looking across behind me, you have several items on the shelves there that I would say were of religious significance.
Yes.
Are you a religious man?
Yes, I am. I'm a Roman Catholic.
How did you reconcile that then?
If I had been a conscientious objector, well, let's go right back to the beginning. I mean, I was bred and born in London, and I joined the Artists' Rifles in 1934, and the territorial unit, one of the ones in London that were designed to produce officers in the event of war. And so I was commissioned off in 1939. We were given our orders in 1938 at Munich time. And so I was sort of led into army habits and customs. And so I sort of started off the war half-trained, shall we say, as a territorial.
Can I bring you back to the question, though, about your faith? I mean, when you went in, you know, at the absolute point of accounting, I suppose, to talk to your priest at confession, what on earth could you have said?
Well, that I killed so-and-so and I'd done this, I'd done that and done the other. But, I mean, in warfare, it's legal.
Looking back on it, are you glad you took part in it? Would you prefer to have been born in another time, another more peaceable time?
Oh, yes. I mean, I enjoyed the war. Overall, I mean, there were some very, very nasty moments in it. But I can't say, having been indoctrinated in Infra-Ireland, I can't really say I was scared. Because, as I said before, we all came away from Infra-Ireland knowing that we were better than anybody else. And whatever job we were given, we could do it better than anybody else, and we would survive, and the other chap would be killed, or the tank would be destroyed, or whatever.
You were saying earlier that you came out in 56, you were a regular soldier. Did civilian life not seem terribly dull, two-dimensional after all that excitement?
Oh, yes, yes, very, 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 very mundane, lacklustre and so on and so forth. But on the other hand, I mean, having been through the actual fighting part of the war, then having served in various other parts of the world, Africa, China, Austria and so on, I was sort of run down.
If you could turn the clock back, I mean, if you could be 22 now, would you want to be involved in the current conflict? How do you think you'd get on? How would you fare?
In the current conflict? Well, I would have just got on with the job. But on the other hand, I just don't believe in this current conflict. I don't see the point of it. I mean, Saddam Hussein was sitting there doing absolutely nothing. Then these chaps came along on September 11th and knocked those two big buildings down in New York. And I think it's sort of spite on Bush's part to take... Saddam Hussein, there's some far, far worse people about in the world than Saddam Hussein. He wasn't doing any harm. He might have been a bloody dictator and treated his people terribly, but, I mean, so does Mugabe, and so does Chinese, and all sorts of people, so do the Russians as well. And, I mean, we've all got chemical weapons, we've all got biological weapons, and, I mean, we were going to use them in the last war. If the Germans had landed, they were going to drop mustard gas on the beaches where they landed, on top of the Germans and on the top of us. I'm very glad I didn't know that until a long time after the war.
One last question. I mean, I know I said that before, but I mean, things keep on occurring to me. As someone who has been through a fighting war, as someone who has seen how human beings react, is it fair to say that the more difficult things become, the less scrupulous you are about how you conduct a war? Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I wouldn't say so. I mean, whatever job you've got to do, whether it's capturing a village or, pushing... like Hill 112, pushing a couple of German divisions off the top of a hill, you just get on with the job, whatever it happens to be. And I don't think scruples come into it.
Well, I was about to say, I maybe phrased that wrong. Scruples is probably the wrong word. You possibly start off with the best intentions, but when your life is personally at risk,
yes,
you're going to do what needs to be done, basically.
Yes. Well, I mean, in warfare, your life is always at risk. You never can tell when the next one's going to come for you. And I managed to last 6 months before I did something stupid and got hit. Entirely my own fault, really, because we were in the Siegfried Line and we captured this particular wood and... there's a lovely German bunker, and that's how I'd been fighting for 6 months. I think we had one or two very couple of days sort of out the line, so to speak. But we were at it most of the time, 99.9% of the time. And I thought, well, I'll just dip into this bunker and have a little bit of a rest, having got my company, having captured this place and got my company sorted out. And, of course, the Germans knew exactly where it was, and they shelled it. And I just happened to be inside at that time. And it was my own idleness of going in there for a little short respite.